This is CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Canada.
Mother Earth is under the weather right now. Mother Earth is under the weather right now.
This week on Radio EcoShock, we'll be exploring citizen action on climate change. We'll hear from Nottingham, England, where action against carbon-spewing power plants is far ahead of North America. In Vancouver, Canada, people are gathering in sustainability cafes. In our main feature, Professor Matthew Patterson, an internationally recognized expert on transportation, explains how difficult it is to separate ourselves from the infernal combustion engine. Car culture, cure it or kill it, coming up. But first, we go to breaking news in British Columbia, where 50 sea lions were killed in a single fish farm net. And that's just the tip of the iceberg, as countless marine mammals are slaughtered for farmed salmon. A storm of public concern erupted after 50 dead sea lions were hauled up with nets in a British Columbian salmon farm. Now it turns out a wide range of marine mammals, including endangered species, are routinely shot or drowned by the Canadian fish farming industry. It's just another black eye for fish farms, which are already accused of killing off wild stocks and polluting the sea. Let's investigate with the Living Ocean Society in Canada. I have Catherine Stewart of Living Ocean Society here in the studio with me. This weekend, all of the newspapers have been covering the deaths of the sea lions over in Clackwood Sound, and I'm wondering if you can fill our listeners in on how this came about.
Well, there is a much higher sea lion population than normal in Clackwood right now, which may be attributed to climate change. The sea lions are following their prey. If the waters are warming and the fish they prey on are moving north, then the lions are too. But the problem is when they encounter fish farms, salmon farms, in open neck cages floating in the ocean, it's like ringing a dinner bell for any marine mammal predator that's attracted to fish. There's, you know, anywhere from 500,000 to a million fish in the average pen in British Columbia, or the average farm in British Columbia. Mm-hmm. And it, of course, is going to attract predators. The farms are issued permits to shoot and kill persistent seals, sea lions, and other mammals that harass the fish in the pens. But in this instance, the sea lions tried to get into the pens themselves and then got caught in the predator nets, which are put out around the farm to protect the farm salmon, and strangled and drowned. Sea lions can stay underwater for about 10 to 15 minutes before they have to surface for air, so it would have been a slow and probably rather painful death. Unfortunately, we know that mammals are going to continue to drown as long as we have open neck cage salmon farms in our waters.
And it's not just the sea lions. Can you tell us about some of the other mammals that have been found in these nets?
Sure. Living Oceans put out a report on Monday in cooperation with a filmmaker at callingfromthecoast.com, Twyla Roskovich, and we released her video, underwater video, of another stellar sea lion caught in a net in the Broughton Archipelago at a mainstream farm. But the same farm, within a three-week period, had also reported the drowning death of a Pacific white-sided dolphin and a harbor porpoise. Both harbor porpoise and stellar sea lions are listed as species of special concern under Canada's Endangered Species Act. Unfortunately, the farms are only required to report to the federal government when they shoot and kill a predator. They're not required to report drowning deaths, so we really have no idea what the scale of the problem coastwide in, you know, the 80 farms that are usually operating at any given time in BC waters could be. There could be a multitude of mammals drowning, and no one in government has a handle on how serious those numbers are.
And yet some of the fish farmers are saying these are just pests, and so they should be shot or trapped or killed.
Well, I'm sure they are an annoyance if you're trying to raise a million fish in pens, and but, you know, this is the mammal's natural habitat, and perhaps the pests are the humans, and we need to look at ways of keeping our activities separate from the marine ecosystem so that we're not killing the mammals, but we're not killing the wild salmon, which are under siege from the fish farms.
And how can we do that?
Well, what Living Oceans and our allies in the Coastal Alliance for Aquaculture Reform are recommending in British Columbia waters are closed contained tanks, some sort of impermeable barrier between the farm fish and the marine ecosystem. This could be done by floating concrete tanks. There's a project in development right now looking at that technology. There have been tests on floating bag systems, which may have their problems. You know, the technology needs work, but it also needs support from our government to make it happen. Because what's happening is the provincial and federal governments are placing more importance on the bottom line of a number of large Norwegian multinationals who run these salmon farms in BC waters than they are on the future health of the marine ecosystem and the salmon stocks that belong to all British Columbians.
And I gather your concerns extend well beyond the sea mammals. The salmon themselves are endangered by these farms. Some people think, well, if you eat a farmed salmon, you're saving the wild salmon, but that isn't so.
No, that's industry marketing, and they're very good at it. But the reality is that when you place a million fish in pens on a wild salmon migratory route, you're going to have disease outbreaks, just like you would in any method of factory farming, which is what this is. And one of the problems on the fish farms is a parasite called a sea louse. And the farms attract the sea lice. They feed them. They're a perfect host for this parasite. You get billions of sea lice eggs being produced on these farms. And then the sea lice attach themselves to the tiny little baby salmon as they're migrating out of their natal streams. Some of these salmon weigh a gram. They're smaller than your little finger. And when they get three, four, five lice sucking their blood and eating their flesh, they die. And the farmers and the government always say, well, there's always been sea lice. Well, yes, there have been. And the sea lice attach themselves to the adult salmon. But nature had a way of protecting the juvenile salmon, because the adult salmon would come back from sea, the wild salmon, with lice on them. And once they entered the fresh water to spawn, the sea lice would fall off and die because they couldn't survive in fresh water. So all the sea lice would die. There'd be no host because the salmon would go upriver, spawn, and they'd die. When the young juvenile salmon emerged in the spring and swam out to sea as such tiny little fingerlings, they wouldn't encounter sea lice. There wouldn't be any. Now they're swimming through a gauntlet of fish farms loaded with lice looking for an easy target, and that's our wild salmon.
So what is your organization proposing to do about this?
Well, Living Oceans and our allies are advocating that the government phase out the open net cage farms, mandate a transition to closed contained tanks, support that with tax incentives for the companies that adopt that technology, invest in alternative energy sources, and, you know, help this to flourish, to provide jobs on the coast and to provide a better product. And then join forces and market the product as a much more ecologically sound type of farm salmon.
And in the meantime, can we go ahead and enjoy salmon from the supermarket?
You should always watch the labels. If it says Atlantic, it's probably farmed, because there are no commercially viable allowed Atlantic salmon fisheries anymore. The wild Atlantic salmon are, you know, hanging on by the skin of their teeth, basically. And so the only wild salmon is Pacific salmon. So first step, you go in the supermarket or a restaurant. If it says fresh, ask if it's farmed or wild. If it says Atlantic, you know it's farmed. Don't eat the farmed, and ask the restaurant or the supermarket to demand that their suppliers provide a more sustainable product. This product from open net cages in Chile, in BC, in Norway is simply not sustainable, and it's destroying ocean health.
And slightly off topic, but I heard that at one of your protests, it was in the newspaper, that one of the premier's men, or somebody at least paid by the Liberal Party, had paid a protester to show up at when you're protesting about salmon farming.
That's right. The groups that I work with were conducting a protest outside a Safeway store because we're trying to get Safeway to change their policy. As a leader in the grocery sector, we feel that they're capable of making that change. And this guy who's currently on trial in British Columbia it was revealed that he paid someone $100 to come down to the Safeway protest where we were asking the company to change their policy and hassle the protest and say that people were destroying jobs on the coast. And this is always the industry's line, and the communities who back the current practices are saying, well, you're going to kill our jobs, you're going to kill our community, you're just opposed to aquaculture entirely. Well, the name of the coalition that Living Oceans is part of is the Coastal Alliance for Aquaculture Reform, and I think the name couldn't speak more clearly about our purpose, which is to change the practices of the industry, make it more sustainable, and make it something British Columbians can be proud of. If they're employed there, they can stand up and say it's a good thing.
And how do our neighbors feel about it in Washington State or Alaska?
Well, Washington State has a few fish farms. Alaska has banned them. Alaska does what's called ocean ranching, which the industry here likes to compare to fish farming, but it's not quite the same thing. They raise the juveniles in pens until they reach a certain size, and then they release them. So they're not concentrating all the waste and the feces and the waste food and the disease that salmon can get when they're crowded into those conditions for their full length of their growth cycle. Just don't develop in the sea pens in the ocean ranching in Alaska. The United States is currently looking at the possibility of offshore aquaculture, which takes it out beyond the 3 or 12 mile limit into the open ocean and has submerged pens. But there's a lot of concern on the part of U.S. environmental groups about the potential impacts of that type of aquaculture as well. Best thing we need to do is enclose the fish, keep them separate from the marine environment, and we'll solve an awful lot of the problems associated with fish farming.
And where can we find out more about this?
You can go to www.livingoceans.org, which is the organization I work with, or you can go to the coalition website, which is called farmedanddangerous.org.
Farmedanddangerous.org. I like that. We've been talking with Catherine Stewart of the Living Ocean Society. Thanks a lot for dropping by.
My pleasure. Thanks for your interest in the issue. It's pretty critical.
This is CFRO 102.7 FM in Vancouver. You are listening to Radio EcoShock, your all-environment weekly program. Find us every Friday at 1 o'clock on the net at coopradio.org or by satellite, Star Choice Channel 845. We are wrapping up our fundraising drive this week, getting the memberships that keep us broadcasting and producing this program. Without your support, alternative and progressive voices on the airwaves go silent. I'd like to thank all the listeners who have made the $50 pledge to keep us on the air. And a special hello to those supporters who bought the $102 Omni membership as super supporters. But we haven't reached our goals yet. As you know, the media world is changing. More people from all over the world are tuning in via the internet. If you are one of them, I'd like to ask for your support now. It's easy to buy a membership from our website at www.coopradio.org. You can pay by Visa or MasterCard on a secure server in just a couple of minutes. If you listen by computer, why not surf over to www.coopradio.org now and join us? That's how we bring you independent reporting without commercials all year long. In addition to needing money to pay our skeleton staff, the rent and transmission costs, the station also needs new equipment to keep up with the digital age. We'd like to upgrade our web presence and deliver more online content, but that all costs money. Please support us either on the web or by calling the station directly at area code 604-684-8494. That's 604-684-8494. If you prefer to mail us a check, send it to Vancouver Cooperative Radio at 360 Columbia Street, Vancouver, BC, with this postal code V6A4J1. That's 360 Columbia Street, Vancouver, BC, V6A4J1. Of all the things you might spend money on, keeping your independent radio station going is very important. Call us at 604-684-8494 and become a member. Now it's time to examine the car culture. Scientific evidence is mounting that cars are killing us in many ways. We know vehicle exhaust fills our lungs with toxic byproducts. These invade even in the womb, deforming DNA and setting up children for all kinds of childhood diseases, such as asthma and cancer, and possibly even autism. Our addiction to oil has fueled wars, terrorism, and unrest in far-flung corners of the world, and may be dictating a militarized society. Meanwhile, the urban sprawl and parking lots of car land have demolished much of our best agricultural pieces. But the largest and possibly fatal challenge is the amount of greenhouse gases pouring out of our tailpipes. The answer is simple, isn't it? We just need to get away from the oil-based car culture. But how likely is that? Professor Matthew Patterson argues that cars are deeply embedded in our self-image, our culture, our economy, and our politics. In a speech given at the Vancouver Institute on April 14, 2007, this internationally recognized expert on transportation and the environment spoke on Moving the Earth, Car Culture, and Global Environmental Policies. This is Alex Smith reporting for Radio EcoShock. Do cars serve us, or the interests of an authoritarian elite? Returning to the late Middle Ages, the period before fossil fuel transportation, Professor Patterson explains how mobility brought more personal freedom, but also war and concentration of wealth. Listening to this, I hear almost a neo-Marxian version of how capitalists used mobility to accumulate wealth and then capture political power. This seems obvious from the early days of railroad barons, followed by oil magnates like John D. Rockefeller, and owners of big car companies, all of whom had immediate contacts with presidents and prime ministers. In many cases, the transportation elite provided the secretaries of state, the top bureaucrats, and even governors and vice presidents. This is why a solution to climate change and other pollution problems caused by car culture is first of all political, and underlying that, economic. After all, the two largest industries in the world today may be vehicle production and the oil to fuel them. We can't dismantle them overnight without retreating from civilization as we know it, and without a revolution in politics. This whole system of power and production, Patterson says, becomes deeply embedded in the individual, through us, generally through advertising images. We express ourselves by what we drive. Let's listen for a minute.
If you like, cars have become deeply embedded in who it is to be us. The cars we drive, the cars we don't drive, our particular relationships to them say a lot about who we did, what sorts of people we are. It is not too much to say, I think, and this is certainly the claim of the book that are coming out and a number of other people who work in this area, that to be a modern person is fundamentally to be mobile, to be moving around, and who we are is defined by where we've been, how we can get about, and it's associated fundamentally with our freedom. We associate, or many of us associate, our freedom with our ability to move around at will without constraint. Conversely, to be insistently not a car driver is frequently to attract attention, even ridicule. Margaret Thatcher, in the country where I grew up, said famously in the mid-1980s that any man, and it was probably specifically a man, who finds himself still on a bus at the age of 30 should count himself as a failure. A failure in life, I think she said specifically. Now, whatever we think of Margaret Thatcher is one thing, but it shows very clearly that being in a car is what is regarded frequently as being a normal person in the societies we live in. Any of the cyclists in the room will be able to tell you, boy is stupid, with tales of being shouted at by car drivers and regarded as sort of somehow deviant. The extremes are maybe the famous stories of, or the extreme cases in, say, Southern California, where people have been known to be arrested for being pedestrians in the wrong place. Just for the act of walking is regarded as suspicious, or grounds for suspicion. Now, one of the most obvious sites, so the question is that one question I think we have to ask is, why has it become the case that we've become so attached to our cars? And why have cars become part of the definition of who it is to be us?
Matthew Patterson has just completed three books on car culture, aimed at both professional and popular audiences. Here is a description of them, given in the introduction to his speech at the Vancouver Institute.
The first is an edited volume, edited with Professor Graham Smith, on environmental politics. published by Routledge. This explores how over recent years environmental politics has moved from a peripheral interest to a central concern within the discipline of politics. The second work, again an edited volume by Professor Patterson and three co-editors, called Against Automobility, published by Blackwell, is a critical account of the impact of the automobile on society, which is both liberated by and reliant upon motor vehicles, and looks at the way the car shapes and the car's role is shaped by our social relationships and our institutions. And then thirdly, Dr. Patterson has published a book, Automobile Politics, published again in 2006 by the Cambridge University Press, that examines the political forces that have made cars so dominant in our lives and looks at how the political and social institutions that sustain this dominance operate to shape our attempts to do something about the car's environmental role.
As Patterson examines different advertising images, he is struck by their invitation to become part of the ruling elite. Cadillac comes right out and says their vehicle speaks of ruling the world. The late Rover Company demonstrates their cars ruling the wilds of Africa exactly as the British did in their days of empire. As he says, the powerful drive, while losers and slobs ride the bus or bicycles, that's the image we were given. These multi-billion dollar advertising campaigns are one of the barriers to changing our carbon pollution and thus saving the climate. When you watch television news or flip through the pages of major newspapers, it becomes clear that all of our information about the world is paid for and mediated by car manufacturing companies and the oil companies hiding behind that industry. And now, car makers are using our love of nature and even our concern about climate change as a way to sell everything from SUVs to hybrids, more cars as a solution for the environment. Cars, trains, and planes are almost synonymous with freedom in our minds, the freedom to travel. In the following clip from his speech, Patterson gives us quite a different take. Governments used to be hostile to travel as a means to secure their power. Now, they depend upon us being detached from the land and location to maintain economic power.
If you look at the history, this will be a Eurocentric history, or a European society from the 17th century onwards, what governors wanted to do, by and large at that point, in general, making big generalisations, was prevent people from moving around. You had all sorts of road tolls, all sorts of barriers, taxes, etc., etc., limiting, principally aimed at limiting people's movement. Governors, monarchs, saw people moving around as a dangerous thing. It's where sedition could rise. It's where, you know, threats of rebellion could be instigated and so on. So they attempted fundamentally to prevent movement. But with the development of the European state system, increasingly governors needed people also to move around more actively. Whether that's for military reasons, to be able to fight more effective warfare, whether that's to develop economic production to be the basis of warfare, and for a variety of reasons, monarchs in France and England and et cetera, created means to try and get people moving more around. To control that movement, certainly, because they didn't want to have too much sedition and rebellion, but they wanted to channel it. But there's always this tension between trying to control the movement but also accelerate it. The apogee in the 18th century is with the French Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars, where you have the levée en masse, which is a sort of where the revolutionary forces are fundamentally directed towards accelerating the way that people move around, channeling the way that people move around in order to fight warfare more effectively. In the 19th century, it then moves. What you then get is a period of that gets transformed from being just getting people to move around more effectively to increase production, etc., to accelerating those movements. And that's the point. It's in the 19th century is when large numbers of people suddenly can move faster than they can walk, with the development in particular of the train. And you get a whole series of social changes consequent on that in terms of how people relate to space differently. People suddenly have much greater distances between where they live and where they work. They start to have greater distances between themselves and the rest of their family. And where mobility starts to become a central part of how they're organized on a daily basis. or certainly much more common than was previously the case. You get the emergence during the 19th century of modern concepts like we have of leisure, where leisure and travel become quite closely related. There is still, however, the tension is that in the dangers of movement, the emergence of rebellions, the emergence of workers' movements is fundamentally to do with their capacity to move and to coordinate their action, for example, which is made more possible with this increased mobility. You could have people suddenly going around in trains stirring up activism for this or that cause. But at the same time, governors need us to move around more to increase production, etc., etc. There's a tension for the governors. There's also increasingly a tension for people moving around. On the one hand, in the French Revolution, for example, freedom of movement was a fundamental part of the political, was the demands that were made by the revolutionaries. But very quickly, with the Levée en Masse, that experiences what some people call a dictatorship of movement. That people started in 1789 with freedom of movement as a demand, and suddenly they found they were being forced to move out all the way around Europe with Napoleonic armies within a matter of 6 or 7 years. And this, throughout the 19th century, this tension between movement, mobility holding out some promise of a better job or of a nicer place to live or whatever it might be, but at the same time suddenly becoming this thing, I've got to get up because the train's going. You become determined by by having to move around for work or whatever other reason. So you get that. There's two types of tension created by societies becoming more and more organised around mobility. So the point that I want to make then is that the world that we now live into of assuming to be mobile on a daily basis, to assume that it's normal to move around over very large distances on a daily basis, to have ties all over the world, and increasingly perhaps less ties to any particular place in the world, to get our needs met across the planet in terms of food and housing and whatever, and to have a certain way of sort of being almost restless, almost nomadic, is the result of not of some natural thing that it's just natural for us to want to be like that, but that we've become like that in part because governors have wanted us to become mobile. It's very useful for how the world that we live in, for us to want to move. If we want to move around and we think of that as part of our freedom, that's actually very good for the economic system and the political system that we also live in.
The First World War, some historians have suggested, was caused partly by train transportation. Troops could be mobilized and moved rapidly, but only along existing lines and according to fixed schedules. In the 1920s, the rigidity of trains gave way to the automobile and trucks. Henry Ford developed the assembly line method of production, which then spread to all kinds of manufacturing, thus leading to the mass consumer culture that is now consuming Earth's resources at record rates. History says Matthew Patterson cannot be disconnected from our transportation system. That seems a key lesson, as we now struggle to modify our whole economic system to prevent catastrophic climate change.
Cars actually more broadly remain absolutely central to the economy. In North America, you still routinely get a figure trotted out that 1 in 7 people employed are associated with the car industry, less in Europe, but nevertheless a very high number of people whose employment depends on the car industry directly or indirectly. The pattern of urban development is still fundamentally organised around assumptions of car ownership and an expansion in car use, and it's despite all sorts of ideas about smart growth or relatively small increases in public money going to public transport over the last 10-15 years, transport spending is still vastly disproportionately on the car, for example. So cars are still central to capitalism.
But the promise of cars can be used for militarism and control as well. Consider Hitler's promise with the Volkswagen.
So those two above forces, the cultural power of cars or how they become powerful and the way that we associate a whole set of important symbols with them, and the way that cars have been central to the way that the economy has been organised in the 20th century, are the central reasons for me that we live in a car-dominated world. They underlie the sort of routine planning decisions that people make about where to put this or this housing development, where to allow a supermarket to be built, etc., etc. Governors have been able to use the way that cars can be understood as giving us freedom of movement for their own purposes, military, economic, and so on. Hitler famously developed the Volksmobil. Precisely, it was very explicit about it being the people's car, and it was going to give all Germans the freedom of car use and so on. Volksmobil, what became the bug here or the beetle in Europe, was sold to a civilian before the war at all. It was all designed for military production, but using these symbols of that freedom and nationalism and so on in that case. So they've been able to use this power, this symbolic power of the freedom of movement, to pursue their legitimacy, and that's been one of the reasons why we've become so attached to our cars. Not the only, but one of them.
In the next piece, Patterson describes how car makers have fought against various pollution controls for decades, stalling improvements needed for health and the environment. He says they make lousy allies for the climate change movement. Other sectors of the economy are coming on board, and the climate change movement is becoming more acceptable in the business community because the financial system sees new ways to make money out of it, through carbon trading, for example.
There is a need to articulate any policy with it to try and green automobility with the interests of at least a substantial part of that big business, that capital. If we look, for example, at the history of air pollution policy, this shows very clearly that the capacity of oil companies and car companies to slow and resist proposals for reform. All of the substantial proposals from the early 50s onwards in California and then elsewhere in North America and Europe and East Asia, through getting rid of lead in petrol, through development of catalytic converters, through the fuel economy standards, through fuel taxation measures, through action to deal with climate change, etc., have all been resisted, mostly successfully, by car companies, successfully in the sense that they've slowed down progress very substantially. And that suggests either, to my mind, the need to look for other allies. So, you know, car manufacturers are not the only firms in the world, and in terms of at least of their economic size, they're in relative decline compared to, say, information technology sectors or one or two others. There's a need to look for other allies that can counterbalance the power of coal and oil funds. If we look at climate policy, for example, as one example of this, the reason that climate policy, in my view, has become tremendously successful, whether it's successful in reducing greenhouse gas emissions is another question, but successful in terms of getting what policymakers call traction in terms of developing the policy, is because they've been designed. They managed to design a policy in terms of, or a set of policies in terms of emissions trading and a whole set of other measures, where financiers, the financial markets, have suddenly decided that climate policy is in their interests, and so they've become quite supportive of climate policy. And so that's an example where, you know, coal and oil firms were lobbying very heavily against the Kyoto Protocol, against other measures to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And they've been able to be sidelined politically because policymakers have been able to go to the city effectively and design policies where lots of city financiers through emissions trading programs and so on can make lots of money and therefore support the policy and enabling the sidelining of car manufacturers.
As a person who prefers bicycles and other modes of travel, Patterson looks at the weaknesses in the car industry that may push change. For one thing, the classic alliance between car companies and the oil industry may be weakening. Even internationalism may stimulate more positive regulations rather than the decline in standards we usually expect.
And secondly, I think there's a sense of using chinks in the car, in the car block's armor. If you look at the California legislation, which started in the early 1990s, to mandate what they call zero emissions from a certain... to mandate that car manufacturers produce a certain proportion of their cars for sale in the California market as what they call zero emissions. And then the idea is that that percentage of cars on the market would have to rise over time. One of the things that did was split the car companies from the oil companies. One of the things it sort of did was made the car companies realize that with all, even though they dragged their feet for 40 years, the vast majority of the costs that have been incurred in responding to environmental regulation have been borne by the car companies, not the oil companies. All the oil companies had to do was take lead out of petrol, which didn't really bother them that much compared to the sort of costs that car manufacturers had undertaken over the years. So there's the ways of opening up the interest of if you like, divide and rule between the sorts of other companies that car manufacturers are often associated with. There's also sometimes possibilities in internationalisation. So, for example, one of the reasons that that catalytic converters were mandated in Europe at the point they were because German manufacturers were competing fiercely with the then dying British car, well, still dying British car industry, over the choice of technology. Thatcher, following the British car industry, was favouring what we call lean burn engines. The Germans favour catalytic converters. So in that case, the diplomatic fight in the European context favoured actually getting something done. Because it's usually people think about internationalisation of being, well, we can't act because our competitors abroad are going to have a cheaper ride. You know, that's a standard argument in Canada, for example, about climate change. If we act and the Americans don't, you know, it'll be, our business will be disadvantaged. In that sort of, in some instances, however, you can design strategies to where you can use your own business, you can favour your own businesses while pursuing more aggressive measures.
Because capitalism is built on the necessity of constant growth, Patterson suggests a plan based on ever-growing limitations will not be accepted by the business world. Instead, he and others suggest a new strategy called smart growth. The vision encompasses whole new industries in sustainable energy and emissionless cars, plus financial markets based on carbon reductions. If we ask people about their cars, most associate them with freedom, yet, as technology and green guilt build up, the car is actually becoming a tool of surveillance and control, Patterson explains.
In terms of thinking about the environmental component of cars, the cultural, as much as the economic, has shifted it towards the more reform version, shifted it towards trying to get people to drive slightly greener cars rather than to reorganise their lives around it. It's promoting alternatives to the car. And, you know, tellingly, I think here it's the move to the suburbs, have a couple of kids, start an RESP. I mean, that's the ideology of what it is, what a normal person does. That's underpinning how that's understood. There's a contradiction here, though, in terms of the cultural power of cars. One of the things is that if you look at the environmental regulation that has been happened, because people are so attached to their cars, but because people at the same time are quite ambivalent and worried about environmental pollution, worried about congestion, worried about threats to their own neighbourhoods, etc., etc., what you've had is progressively over a long period of time is actually more and more intrusion in our daily lives. If you drive a car now, you're much more just surveyed on a daily basis almost in terms of, you know, with CCTV quite frequently in urban traffic situations, with a whole set of inspection maintenance regimes on the car where you go every year and you have to get your drive clean tests or whatever it might be. The systems vary in different jurisdictions. But whereas car drivers, you're actually surveyed. And now with GPS, I mean, GPS is talked about as, you know, OnStar, for example, the GM system is talked about how, you know, it's going to enable them to get you if you've broken down and you're in the middle of nowhere. But it also enables the state to know where you are at any one time. If they need to find you, they can find you. And some countries have now started to talk about using GPS as automated fines, to generate automated fines for speeding. They can tell you for speeding if they want to. Technologically, that's already possible. And, you know, given a whole set of pressures, so as we become more and more attached to our cars, but we also worry about all the consequences of us all using cars, that means actually we become more and more surveyed as we car. As we use our cars. And with the possible thing, of course, with the consequence that it attenuates the idea that we're free as a car driver. On the one hand, we're being surveyed. On the other hand, a lot of the technologies to try and green car driving, the logical outcome of them is that they will abolish the driver. We'll all be driving around in automated cars, where we won't be a driver in any serious sense. We'll just say, I want to go, you know, we talk to the car and say, I want to go to work today, please, and it will take you to work. And it's all based on a smart highway where you can drive, because everything's automated, you can drive a yard and a half away from the car in front of you so that there's no congestion, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But then what's the freedom of being in a car if you're not driving it? So there's a cultural contradiction there that cars are associated with freedom, but actually because we're so attached to them, We become less free as we drive because we're being more surveyed, etc.
Perhaps to our dismay, Matthew Patterson doesn't offer any neat solutions to the car dilemma at the end of his speech. His mission has been to point out how complex and deeply embedded cars have become in our culture, our economy, and our system of political control. In the question period, Patterson suggests the current trend of retro cars, like the PT Cruiser or the revived Mustang, represent a denial of the real problems in car culture.
I think that fits within the same thing. There's a nostalgia for a past, and one of the nostalgia amongst car buffs and car firms, like if you think of Chrysler, wouldn't it be nice if we didn't have all the problems we have now? We don't have to deal with all this environmental regulation. We don't have to deal with all these people slagging us off for being so hot, you know, useless on X, Y, and Z. Wouldn't it be nice if we can go back to the golden age?
Yet his research doesn't show health as a primary motivation to change our dependence on cars. All of the concerns, from high fatalities in accidents to smog killing people, have been known and tolerated for half a century. Health-related improvements come very slowly after decades of struggle, not quickly enough to prevent rapid global warming. Answering another question, Patterson's inside sources tell him the fuel cell is the engine of the near future, not 20 or 30 years from now, but going on sale commercially around 2012. Fuel cells are far more efficient than gasoline engines or diesels, but the unanswered question is, where does the massive amount of electricity required to split hydrogen from water come from? If the source is coal, we're cooked. If it's nuclear, we risk radiating the planet. Despite these gaps, he thinks the hydrogen-powered fuel cell will replace the internal combustion engine in our lifetimes. You can hear all this discussion in the question and answer period, which is available for download, along with the full speech, at the Radio EcoShock website. Go to www.ecoshock.org and look for Transportation in the Audio On Demand menu. You can contact Professor Patterson at the School of Political Studies, University of Ottawa, Canada. I'm Alex Smith, and thanks for listening. Our thanks to Professor Patterson and the Vancouver Institute for letting us record and pass this on. Don't forget you can download the full speech from the Transportation section of our website at www.ecoshock.com. Or listen to it next Tuesday on CFRO's Brown Bagger program at noon. This is CFRO 102.7 FM Co-op Radio, and we're making our final effort to get members we need to keep on going. If you are a regular listener, no doubt you've heard all the good reasons to join. Maybe you have been thinking about it. Maybe you hope somebody else will cover all the bills. Well, it's time to face reality. This station's future really is up to you. Instead of a big corporation playing bland blunk between waves of commercials, CFRO is listener-owned and has been for the last 30 years. But don't take that for granted. Without returning memberships and new people joining, we won't have enough to keep broadcasting. Please do your part to help us keep going by phone 604-684-8494 and ask about our different membership plans. Some people prefer to donate as little as $10 a month. People living on a fixed income can join for just $25 a year. Those with a decent income know they can donate more, and everybody can get a tax deduction slip if you need one. Call us now at 604-684-8494. And tell them you like Radio EcoShock. Each show competes a little to help keep the station going, and I'd be proud to know that Radio EcoShock listeners are willing to act to keep this program and its station on the air. 604-684-8494, or join us on the web at cooperadio.org.
The bitterest truth that I have to tell you today is that we're not going to stop global warming. It is too late to prevent global warming, to keep it from happening. The only question for our time is whether we can figure out how to keep things from getting entirely out of control. That is the moral challenge for the century we're now entering. It's hard to figure out exactly how to put it in ways that will really move people. Saying, our challenge as a generation is to keep the atmospheric concentration of CO2 below 550 parts per million is a difficult sell. But there it is, you know. That's the dream that people in our time and place have to embrace and make the most of.
That's Bill McKibben speaking at the Bioneer 7 conference. Find out more at bioneers.org. When it comes to climate change, people in Europe are way ahead of North America. Over there, it's very difficult to find anyone who doubts that global warming is happening and our carbon dumping is responsible. Even at a country bar, you'd be laughed out of the room as a climate denier. I'm going to play you a piece of independent media put together by some folks in Nottingham, toward the north of England. These aren't professional radio producers, just a new breed of audio-savvy activists capturing a community climate event. Maybe we'll get a few good ideas for our own hometown.
Stand in line or I want you, I'll wake up. You're what? And you'll be gone. I need to remember you're just an insignificant figment of my magnificent dream. That old wife's tale about pinching yourself and make you feel pain when you're awake. There's nothing to it. Observe, figment of my imagination, I pinch myself. The pain's pain. Still I dream.
If you look at the vast array of science that's available to explain what's going on here, there isn't anyone that contradicts the fact that there is a serious problem. And the worst case scenario is we've got like 8 years to make a 90% reduction in our CO2 emissions.
Everybody will suffer in the end as a result of climate change. The planet will survive, but ourselves and all the creatures on it will suffer as a result of it.
Why do you think people are apathetic?
Because perhaps they see it as a long-term issue, and it's always being reinforced to them it is a long-term issue. If you just look at what the politicians are saying, when they set targets to achieve, they always talk about a target of we will reduce such and such at some point in the future. So it's a target for 2030. So people don't see that there's a real need to do something now.
Why is there a need to do something right now?
Because the need is pressing and the consequences of what we do take time to kick in. We can't wait and keep putting it off and putting it off.
Okay, today we've got the Big Sprout Day out, which is a family day as part of Spring Into Action. And this afternoon we've got loads of different art workshops using reclaimed and recycled materials. We've got music and we've got different activities for kids to bring in different sorts of people. The idea of today is really to be accessible to children and families and bring in different people who might not know about climate change or might not think so much about environmental issues and get them involved in lots of fun ways.
I'm making an amazing handbag out of plastic bags, out of carrier bags.
It looks like you're weaving strips of a cotton plastic bag.
That's exactly what I'm doing. I'm weaving bits of carrier bag in and out of each other on top of what appears to be some sort of like office tray, which is the loom. And apparently, if I carry on doing this, I can make an amazing handbag.
It's a good example, though, of using a material that, a plastic bag, which, you can get... or shouldn't be using actually from shopping, but you can get them where people have used them, and it's really, really strong because of course shopping bags stay in the environment for thousands and thousands of years, so it's a really nice way of using something and putting it to proper use rather than it going in some landfill. And they're also very, very beautiful objects.
Shortly after 9 o'clock, around 11 protesters gained access to the power station here. They chained themselves to power station property. Various reports, some say they chained themselves to iron railings, some say to machinery and perhaps dumper trucks. Either way, we do know in the last few minutes from the police that 11 people have been arrested.
Today we're here to draw attention to the energy industry and the power stations, which here are using coal, which is one of the dirtiest fuels available to us. We're drawing attention to the fact that power stations and our whole energy industry is responsible for 30% of CO2 emissions in this country, that although the government's been talking about targets and trying to reduce CO2 emissions, it's actually at the highest level it has been for 10 years. And we have very, very little time to act on this. We've only got a few years.
What sort of results can you hope to achieve by having activists inside chaining themselves to power stations?
Well, with actions like this, it's about trying to disrupt the actual running of a power station like this. It's about drawing public attention to it and also drawing attention to it from the people who kind of take part in these industries. We all know what the effects of climate change will be. We all know that we're actually on track for a 3-degree rise in temperature if we continue the way we are, and that's going to lose half the Amazon rainforest, kill off loads of species, make lots of places habitable. We're going to create lots of refugees through it, and it's an endless catastrophe. We know about it, we know how serious it is, and we are the generation that has to act on it. If we don't, then it will be too late.
What's happening inside at the moment?
At the moment, I believe that the protesters are in there who've been chained onto some of the equipment, that the police have come in and started to cut through some of those chains, so some of those protesters have been arrested.
We had an email over the weekend about Spring Into Action Day, and there were many other areas in the East Midlands that suggested might be targets, the M1 widening scheme, East Cross incinerator and East Midlands Airport. Have you any plans for any more disruption over the next couple of days?
As far as I know, today is really sort of where the actions are happening. All of those things that were listed as targets are massive emitters of CO2. They're responsible for a lot of things that are going to contribute to climate change. They also, we should draw attention to them. I think there has been lots of things happening over the past year that have drawn attention to those, and there will be again in the future. That's all I know. I think everybody is becoming aware of the fact that it's a major issue and that serious action needs to be taken in a very short amount of time. And personally, I think it's really, really important to get children and young people inspired about it, because it's their generation that's going to feel the impact of climate change. And the whole Spring Into Action event is about the fact that we've got very little time to make huge amounts of changes in our lifestyles, basically, because the way that we live is totally unsustainable. So getting the message across to people and showing people that there are lots of alternatives, lots of positive alternatives, which are fun and interesting and stimulating and involve working together. That's kind of the idea behind today.
That was from Nottingham, England. But you are listening to CFRO Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Canada. Things are really picking up here too. Every week in the paper we see notices of a speech by someone trained at the Al Gore Climate Camp, followed by a climate film. We've recently had a full climate film festival, and this month there are a series of cafes dedicated to sustainability for the environment. In fact, it's called 30 Days of Sustainability. Last night I went to the Lookout, the scarily high tower in Vancouver, where you can walk around for a 360-degree view over the whole city. Incidentally, I noticed most of it was brightly lit up, including all those office towers who leave their lights on overnight, pointlessly wasting electricity. There I attended a table cafe led by Simon Fraser University energy guru Mark Jacquard. Oh, and by the way, he's also a top economist advising governments. If you check out our website, you'll find a feature I did on Professor Jacquard's study on the feasibility of real clean coal, where the carbon is captured and then sequestered underground. Every month, several hundred people download that feature, or his full one-hour speech from the Vancouver Institute, also posted on our website at www.ecoshock.org. But the cafe atmosphere was a real treat. A very informed bunch of participants got to ask one-on-one questions with this expert, who advises governments, including the government of China. I'll be running excerpts from that table talk in next week's show. And that's just one of dozens of cafe talks on offer with titles like Conscientious Consumption, Electric Cars and Trucks, Human Migration and Climate Change, or Sustainable Homes. Each comes with a resident expert and a chance for you to get your questions answered, and they are all free. Get more info at www.30daysofsustainability.com. There's a full calendar on the web. This is a great example of how to get the community talking. Maybe you can get a sustainable cafe series going in your community. Isn't it time we started talking about how we're going to preserve a livable Earth? Obviously, the politicians aren't going to fix it all for us. It is up to us. Get your ideas and new connections at Sustainability Cafes, www.30daysofsustainability.com. Here's another example. Students of Simon Fraser University created an interactive art display for Surrey secondary students to experience how personal choices affect the environment. For example, in one room, they were allowed to drink as much juice as they wanted. But then, how many cups did they use and what did they do with them? They find out after they leave. The exhibit is called Consume Now, Think Later. Check it out on the web at www.sfu.ca/bluebox/consumenow. Incidentally, that isn't a message I'm trying to push. No consume now here. I've been waiting for more action by young people, whose futures are most at stake. Apparently that wave is beginning to grow. We need a tsunami of youth action and demands to get this country moving on climate change. You've been listening to Radio EcoShock on CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. Don't forget to make your pledge. Call us at 604-684-8494 to get a membership. We need your support. Keep non-commercial, independent radio on the air. Call us at 604-684-8494. And thanks so much for listening to Radio EcoShock and supporting this program. Let's go out with a bit of music. Casey Neal singing Hallowed Be Thy Ground from the album Songs for the Earth, a tribute to Rachel Carson, a great album available from www.musemusic.org.
His banana hail of western Tennessee, great central hardwoods of the Ozarks and the Shawnee. Fireflies illuminate the swamp at dark, exploding like embers, scattering like sparks. Forests are the finest refuge this body has known, and I'll stray away where the trail is overgrown, where the trail is overgrown. Surf to pound, hallowed be thy ground, and all your high mountains with glory crown. The play of a light through thickets of cottonwood, play a light on the river, on the banks where I've stood. Further west to the continental divide, where the mighty wild Rockies do thrust and collide. Scree sloping down to the valley below, and lush alpine meadows where the arnica grows, arnica grows. Hallowed be thy ground, and holier blue ocean where the wild surf does pound. Hallowed be thy ground, and all your high mountains with glory crown. Gotta run to the mountain, run to the mountain. Run to the mountain, run to the mountain, run to the mountain. Ever seen every drainage, every rivulet, the twilight sheen of the wild inhabitations in the heart of hinterland. A dialect is spoken you can almost understand. The step of the seasons, the treasure of terrain, it has changed me so completely. I'll never be the same, never be the same. Hello. Wild surf this town. Hallowed be thy ground, and all your high mountains of glory. Hallowed be thy ground, and holier blue ocean where the wild surf does pound. Hallowed be thy ground, and all your high mountains with glory.
wild surf does pound.
Hallow
knee thy ground and all your high mountains with glory crown.